Those that are staying here, go ahead and turn back to our text. 1 Kings chapter 2. When David is preparing to die, preparing his son to reign, Solomon, who happened to be one of his younger sons, let's go ahead and read it, 1 Kings chapter 2. Now the days of David drew nigh that he should die. And he charged Solomon his son, saying, I go the way of all the earth. Be thou strong, therefore, and show thyself a man. I'm dealing with the subject of manliness, which has changed in our culture. The idea of manliness is almost now treated as if it's just a human construct based on tradition that doesn't have any basis in reality. And so now it's just a matter of whether you're old-fashioned enough to still think of the concept. And the idea of manliness also nowadays is about typical behavior of men rather than in the dictionary definition and how it's always been the ideal behavior of men. And they'll talk about manliness as in, wanting to be into sports and drinking beer and, being a woman chaser, and that's what they consider manliness. And I can see a difference in our culture somewhere around the 1950s. Something changed, and it was a very radical and thorough change in our culture, so that manliness now is basically denigrated and disdained. And if you look in the media, or you listen to too much news or Hollywood or whatever, if you get too much information from the main outlets, what you'll find is manliness and manhood itself is denigrated. It is looked down upon, or at least it's attempted to. You find men being self-effacing. Men themselves joke about manliness. They actually joke about it. You'll hear preachers talk about, and in fact, we hear it, we do it all the time. I've heard it so often, it's so commonplace, where preachers or men will say, who the boss is in the family, and they're joking around that it's the wife that's the boss. And the reason why we joke about that is because we don't want to face the fact that people don't accept men being the boss in the family. Seniority of men it's a taboo subject nowadays. And if you don't believe me, just bring it up in the workplace with a female co-worker, and you'll see what I'm talking about. What I'm telling you is that manliness actually does exist. It is a real, it's something real and based in nature. It has a DNA component that it is based on our physical differences in somewhat. It's also got a cultural component, meaning cultures develop around the differences between men and women, and assign roles, understood roles for both men and women, and that also creates a distinction and an ideal of manliness in that culture, which might differ somewhat from another culture. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist or that it's just cultural. It has more than one component. And then, of course, we have a Bible component, which is the Bible gives us some of God's revelation, the mind of God explaining to us, what it's about. And the Bible does actually deal with this subject, even though it doesn't use the word manliness itself. I want to say that industrialization created opportunity, at least potential opportunity, for women that society resisted giving to women. And this is what spawned the women's suffrage movement back in the 1800s after the Second Great Awakening. In fact, the Second Great Awakening spawned three great movements. The first of them was abolitionism, and that was to stop the slavery and the oppression of people on the basis of their race. And this was an unfair practice and an unjust practice, unrighteous, I should say. There's a lot of things that are unfair that are not unrighteous, folks. But that was an unrighteous practice, and it needed to be stopped. And the Second Great Awakening really got the ball rolling on that, and it turned out to cause quite a bloody struggle over it, but that's how society resists. It also spawned the temperance movement, which is, let's stop the drugs, let's stop the drinking. The industrialization of society caused drinking to be a real problem. And I'm not going to go into that because that's a whole different subject. But the third movement that was happened was the emancipation of women, that is, women's suffrage. And women's suffrage came to pass in the 1920s sometime with an amendment to the Constitution allowing women to vote. And, you know, it's pretty much inevitable if you're going to have a popular vote, majority rule democracy. It's inevitable that, you know, the idea is everybody ought to have a voice and you shouldn't be ruled by somebody else. Everybody should have a voice. And if everybody has a voice in how they are ruled, well, then women deserve a voice too. Now, if you have no problem at all with popular vote, majority rule democracy, then you probably think that's all right and dandy. I personally find great failings in that form of government. And so I don't believe anybody specially has a right to vote. And I believe God has made certain things set up clear. And so we can have disagreements. But if we're going to have this kind of government that we have, well, of course, women ought to be able to vote. Women ought to have their say in the matter, too. And women ought to be able to be president and all these other things, and even have a leadership position in a business or what have you. If they can do the job, then they ought to have that same opportunity. Industrialization created that opportunity for women. But something happened after they achieved equality under the law. They wanted more than that. They wanted equality as an objective of law. Now, you got to understand the difference. When you have equality under the law, that is, the law applies to all people equally, that's commendable and it's righteous, it's just. But then to say that you want the law to promote equality and cause people to be equal in practical way, that's different. There's a difference there. You understand the difference? And nowadays, Even the Civil Rights Act, which was absolutely good and righteous, the Civil Rights Act that says the public funds and all that stuff have to be distributed without discrimination and all the public assistance and all these things. And that's true. But nowadays we have the GBL whatever community making statements claiming in our city council meetings that what they demand is that the law provide respect for them. That the laws have to be made in order that they could have an equal respect. And folks, no law can make me respect homosexuality. You can pass a law if you want, but it's not going to make me respect it. And they'll pass the law, and in fact they did pass the law, and they made some provisions to make some Christians happy, and that might have made some Christians happy, but the idea that I cannot make a decision based on my beliefs and speak out against homosexuality, because that's disrespectful or insulting, that is not only an absurd law, it's an unjust, unrighteous law. And they're going to reap the rewards of making those kind of laws. It's going to happen. There's going to be damage done to our society because of it. And it's spreading the nation, folks. This is a deal that's happening. Our nation is being perverted in front of our eyes by the Hollywood culture and many other things. Now, I can tell you one thing, there is an actual reality involved. When the women's liberation movement, or what we call the radical feminism of the 1960s took place, and they began to demand equal pay, they began to demand abortion on demand, you see, because women aren't truly free until they can, you know, control their own bodies completely. And that makes sense, right? I mean, how can a woman be free to compete in the workplace if when she gets pregnant, she has to have the baby? They can't compete, so they had to have abortion on demand so that, and ladies, you know, the feminist movement, folks, it was one thing to say, we want the same rights, the laws to apply to us the same, and we need the right to be able to vote. That's understandable. But when you say that we want the right to not be women, to not have the limitations that are put upon us by our very nature, well, that's wrong. Right. You've decided to go against God. And it's come to the point now where people who are born male They want to go against God and say, I'm not really male. They've invented what's called a gender identity, meaning that in your mind you might be a woman, even though on your body you're a man, which is really quite silly. It's really absurd, and there is no scientific basis for this. There's no studies that prove that some people are really women in the mind and men in the body. There are no studies that show that. It's just an assumption that is made because it fits their perverted concept, their worldview. That's in it fits. And also, I'll tell you another reason why. It's because it's anti-Christian. And people don't like Christianity. They don't like the Bible. And so when something comes up that seems to challenge the Bible, they will be championed by a whole lot of people in our society. Well, all of this has happened, and it's caused a denigration of manliness and manhood. And folks, I don't have any illusions about change in our society. I have no thought that somehow by teaching the truth, it's going to dawn on people, oh, now we see how wrong we were. That hasn't happened in any of my arguments. So I'm pretty sure it's not going to happen by teaching it. But one reason why I teach these sort of things, and I've taught them in all my churches, and I've taught them in my individual classes, and I've written articles about these things, one of the reasons why is so that I can actually be a voice to what is true, and you can do with the truth whatever you want. In fact, I can tell you this, many of the opponents of manliness are Christian women and Christian men. Even just the self-effacing sort of laughing about how the wife is the boss at the home. We all know who the boss is, right? And all this kind of thing where men are just kind of a little bit nervous about asserting their manhood. And fella, I tell you, that's the honest the truth. You become a little bit hesitant to assert your manhood because you have been conditioned to be almost ashamed of it. And it has become in our society a pressure to not really equalize the sexes, but to squash the concept, the feeling, the self appreciation or the self-esteem of men as men because they were made men by God and deserving of a certain distinguishing honor just because God made them men and for no other reason. Didn't get a lot of amens on that, but I'm going to tell you, women will say, well, that's not fair. It is not fair for men to have a position of privilege and distinction and a special respect just because they're men. That's not fair. And I tell you what, ladies, you can take that up with God when you meet Him and you can say, God, that was not fair. And He will say, I wasn't really into fair. He was into function. He's always been into function. He wants things to work. And that's why I'm telling you, this difference between the genders, this difference actually does exist, and it causes a certain idealization of certain attributes for men. That is, that we would say certain attributes are more appropriate in men than they are in women. I got one right and one amen. That is excellent. Man, I am improving. It's working, brothers. Man, I'm actually convincing somebody. Listen, some attributes are more important in men than they are in women. And some attributes are more important in women than they are in men. Now realize that's a relative statement. It's a statement of comparison. Some attributes are more appropriate to men. It doesn't mean those attributes are not appropriate at all in women. Strength, for example, we need strong women. Women need some strength. And it's a valuable thing. But I can tell you, strength is more important in a man than it is in a woman. And grace and charm are more important in a woman than they are in a man. Now, these are just relative things. The truth is, if you took the very, very strongest woman and put her up against an average man, she would whip him. I guarantee it, it would happen because there are some strong women out there. The differences are relative. They're fairly minor. Women aren't so weak they can't open the door for themselves. Most doors they can open. But some doors, they need a big jerk. Right? Ain't that right, Debbie? Me and Debbie were in an argument one time, had sort of one of them, not a knockdown dragout. We never have a knockdown dragout. She's just not mean enough. But we had this argument, and she got upset, and she walked out of the room, and then she came in there and says, "Bill, can you come here?" And I said, "What you need?" She says, "I can't get this door open, and I need a big jerk on it." So we can say she won that argument. All right, guys. All right. Women resisted, society resisted the emancipation of women. And that was not fair, folks. It was not right for women to be denied the opportunities that the industrialization of society gave them. I mean, men didn't deserve it any more than women did to have an easier life. And so, when society resisted it based on tradition, it created this idea that it's all wrong. And it's not all wrong, folks. There's some things, it's true, and even considering the differences that we see between men and women, and they do exist, but a whole lot of traditional or stereotypical differences between men and women are just really not true. People say men are this way and women are this way. If you read, men are from Mars and women are from Venus, I've not read that, but they talk about the differences between men and women. And I can guarantee you, all the articles I've read about this subject, I have to say, I disagree with an awful lot of those supposed differences. It's not necessarily true. I guarantee there's not a whit bit of difference between their intellects. Men and women are equally intelligent. God never treats women as inferior intellectually. He expects them to understand everything. He expects them to be taught how to read and all that. We're not Muslims. We don't need our women to be ignorant and repressed and set aside. But at the same time, we don't want to go so far as to say there aren't any real important differences between us. There are real, important, and necessary differences between us, set up by our DNA, set up by our culture, which is important, and set up on what the Bible actually says. Let's deal with a couple of things. All right, based on our physical differences, DNA, or genetics, the difference between the sexes is important for the survival of the individual and of the species. And I'll let you know that survival and reproduction are about the same thing. Survival, not just survival of one, but the reproduction of himself and herself. You haven't really survived if you're the last one of your breed. Even if you lasted past a whole lot of stuff, when you die, then you die off. And of course, that's one of the biggest problems with homosexuality is that it's a self-destructive behavior in that you don't reproduce. You're done. The species is done if everybody goes that way. It's a real problem. It is self-destructive behavior because you have to reproduce to survive. Now, and the division of the sexes, I get a kick because if you're an evolutionist, you've really got a problem here. And that is, how did the differences between men and women come about considering evolution? And they have to, if they're honest, well, they'll say, well, it's because it conferred an advantage. But to confer an advantage, it has to already exist. And so we're asking not how it helps us now, but how did it come to pass? How did it come? And they have to say, well, it happened by random mutations. In other words, some poor little child was born different, turned out to be a boy child, and fortuitously, somewhere else, another child was born different, happened to be a girl child, and that's how we got all started on this. Now listen, that is just as absurd as it can possibly be, and it's not even worth contesting, but let me tell you something. When God made us function, the truth is the distinction between man and woman as a survival, as a need, as a necessary component of survival of ourselves and of our species and the protection of our children and all of these things, it is incredibly necessary. It's beyond measure necessary. For example, a woman bears children. Well, while she's bearing children and then carrying them and then nursing them and then taking care of them and nurturing them, she can't forage for food very well. And she can't, if we're talking about cavemen, they can't survive. Somebody's got to take care of the kids and somebody's still got to be able to fight. It's just normal. You got to have a division of function, a division of labor. And anybody that has a business knows we got to get somebody to do this and somebody to do that. And if anybody says that's not fair, they just need to realize it's not about fair. Amen. I have never had my left hand complain about holding the nail. I've tried to hammer with my right hand holding the nail and my left hand holding the hammer, and it doesn't work. It's not about fair. It doesn't matter if the left hand always has to hold the nail. I would tell my left hand, you're just so good at it. And I would tell my right hand, please get better. Right? It's about function. It's not about fair, folks. It's not about equality. It's about God making something that really, really works. And it really works. It's a good thing. It's a healthy thing. But it's not fair. No, it's not fair. Somebody's got to do the providing while somebody does the caring. Somebody's got to provide the defense while somebody does the nurturing. Somebody has to get some dominion over nature, like God says, go and have dominion over all the nature. And that's our job. We are to take over and have dominion over nature. Somebody's got to be focused on that while somebody else focuses on something else. This is part of our DNA makeup. Now, with that known, you can see that there's a difference in roles. Now, this is what radical feminism cannot stand, the idea of roles. Because it means you're stuck. Means there's no getting out of this. These are the roles. And look, the Bible speaks about women that it would be actually better off for them personally if they wouldn't get married and they would just serve the Lord and be serviceable to God and the community and everything else by not being married and not getting stuck into that where you have to take care of kids and take care of your husband. The Bible actually talks about that as a tremendous advantage and a useful thing. And every woman should consider that. However, when it comes to the actual roles in society, these roles exist. These roles are necessary. These roles are part of our DNA. Women are going to be, well, what can I say? Women are better mothers than men. And men are better fathers. Men are better caregivers. Simply they are. I'm not trying to put you down and say, oh, you're just a caregiver. You're just somebody at home taking care of that. I do not despise motherhood at all. Amen. All right? But I'm not sorry I'm not a mother, and I'm not trying to be a mother. I never needed the experience of breastfeeding or any of that stuff. That's never part of my desire. Women are better listeners. Women are better comforters. All of these things are true. You can argue if you have an agenda. You can say, I don't believe that. I think we're... Well, whatever. If you need comforting, don't come to me. You need a shoulder to cry on. Don't come to me, folks. All right. Men are better fathers. Men are better soldiers. Men are better firemen. Men are better coaches. Yeah. Women are better kindergarten teachers. Amen. I guarantee it. I would be a horrible kindergarten teacher. Say, get over it, kid. You didn't keep that within the lines. You colored outside the lines. That's no good. Go try again. Yeah. But men are better coaches. Simply put, men are better coaches. Stop whining. Stop crying. Get up. Try again. Harder. You didn't do that well. Try again. That's what coaches have to be. And men are better at that, okay? I'm not just being stereotypical here. I'm just saying this is reality, folks. This is in our DNA. It's part of us. Now, here's the bad one. This is the one that's going to hit the fan. Men are better leaders. Not trying to put you down. Now listen, everybody, if necessary, can do all of those jobs. If you find yourself to be a single mom, whether because someone died or you know someone left you or whatever, well, you can do it.
Yeah.
And if you came to me and asked me, how am I going to do that? I said, well, you can do it. A lot of women have done it.
Yeah.
A lot of women have taken the role of fathers, and you have to try to be a father in some way to those poor children that don't have a father. A father deadbeat dad left them or whatever. You've got to just do it. You're going to have to do it. But who's going to argue with the fact that a father would be a better father? A father would be. And women have had to lead. Let me show you. Look at Judges. You might know this story. Look at Judges chapter 4. Let's start with verse 4. Judges 4:4. And Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, she judged Israel at that time. Wow. And she dwelt under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in Mount Ephraim. And the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. She was an exceptional woman. You can see that. And she sent and called Barak, the son of Abinoam, out of Kadesh Naphtali, and said unto him, hath not the Lord God of Israel commanded, saying, go and draw toward Mount Tabor, and take with thee 10,000 men of the children of Naphtali and of the children of Zebulun. And I will draw unto thee to the river Kishon, Sisera, the captain of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his multitude, and I will deliver him into thine hand. And Barak said unto her, if thou wilt go with me, then I will go. But if thou wilt not go with me, then I will not go. And she said, I will surely go with thee. You can see the disdain in this person's voice. Notwithstanding, the journey that thou takest shall not be for thine honor, for the Lord shall sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. And Deborah rose and went with Barak. Now, here we have Barak, and he's a man. But he wasn't near the man he needed to be. And we find that the woman was a whole lot more leadership qualified. Now, I agree. Some women are exceptional. And I tell you what, I would vote for a woman if she was qualified. I would actually vote. I'm not against having a woman president, folks. In my opinion, there is no glass ceiling. I don't believe in that. I don't believe there's a glass ceiling. I would not hesitate to vote for a woman if she would just stand up and say what I think ought to be said. I've had a real hard time voting for any of the candidates lately. They're just pitiful. And so wheelie washy, this wishy washy sort of just gunk what comes out of their mouth. I just tired of listening to them. Why can't somebody stand up and just be truthful? Well, I'll tell you why. Because they won't get elected if they are. Once again, we get back to my argument against popular vote, majority rule democracy. Well, I'm not going to get into that. I'm going to try my best not to get into that. Anyway, let me tell you something. Over the years, all cultures have developed certain cultural norms for men and women, including the style of dress. It's hard to find any culture, no matter how small or how remote, anywhere where men and women dress the same. They don't dress the same. They dress different. Now, you can say, well, that's just, you know, because of an imposition of society and because the Bible and the caveman, you know, mentality and whatever. Come on, folks. Every single culture, all of them had this terrible prejudice against women and held them down and kept them back and what? No, folks, it has to do with the culture developing naturally useful roles. And everybody wants to be useful. I don't want to do something very honorable poorly. I would rather do something less honorably well. In other words, I would rather be a good garbage pick-upper than a really bad president. Right? Everybody wants to be good at what they do. And so we need to find out what our gifts are. Even in our church, we need to find out what our gifts are. We don't want people who have no sense of music leading the singing. We need someone that gets an idea of the beat and what have you. At least, you know, so that their hands are moving at the right... you know, at the right beat or something. It's got to happen. We want people who are good at something. And so in every culture, you find that women are better mothers and better caregivers and better things like this, and men are better leaders. And so that's what generally happens. And then this produces norms and roles for men and women. In all cultures, all of them have it. Industrialization narrows that difference somewhat. You realize, I don't know if you understand how that has happened. You realize that back in the 50s, it was very difficult for a woman to be able to drive a car because they didn't have power steering, they didn't have power brakes, and they didn't have automatic transmissions. I remember those cars. You know, I was a little bit after that, but I drove some old cars back then, and I'm telling you, try to parallel park, you know, a 1955 big old monster car. That's not an easy thing to do. But now, folks, seriously, you can steer a car with one finger. Women can steer a car just fine. They've been equalized in a tremendous way. It's a great advance in the way of equalization. Women can drive big old airplanes. It's possible. It's all possible. They can drive those huge trucks. Because it's all just all automatic. I mean, this is great. That's super. And who would begrudge that? I want my daughters and my wife to be able to drive. I don't want to have to drive them everywhere. The fact that industrialization has narrowed the gap doesn't mean there is no gap, that there is no difference, that there is no appropriate attitude and aspect and attributes of men and other appropriate ones for women, and these things are different. It just means that there are some adjustments that need to be made, but not to throw out the whole concept. This is part of our... Let me tell you something else. Just the fact that it's part of our culture makes it important. Just the fact that it's part of our culture. You do owe something to your past, to your heritage. You owe something. I realize that some things have to change. I realize that. But tell me that it's not important at all the way our forefathers used to do things? You're wrong. It is important. Not one amen. All right. That's all right.
Amen.
Let me tell you something. Equality and, you know, equal pay for equal work. I talked to this to a lady just recently. She was visiting me at my office, and I had my notes. It says manliness on the front of it. She looks at that and she says, "What's that about?" And so I kind of like had to explain it to her a little bit, and you know, it didn't really go over terribly well. But she's a very liberated woman, and she says, "Well, I believe in equality." And I said, "Well, now, I don't really believe in equality that much. I'm not into equality a whole lot. I think equality under the law is great, but I think what's more important is righteousness." I said, "If you would treat everybody else out of the true principle of love toward them and wanting the best for them, you would achieve all the good that you're getting out of equality and not get any of the bad. If you would be righteous toward each other." Think about it in the civil rights concept. If people had been truly righteous and love their neighbor as themselves when it came to civil rights, whether or not, you know, you're allowing a black person to move into your neighborhood, or if you'd just been righteous, if our society had been righteous, there would not have been a discrimination problem. And we would have all still had our right of association. But because they were so wicked in this country, so wicked in the way of racial discrimination and just plain disdain and ultimate hatred in our hearts for people who are a little different than us, or people that we feel awkward around, or whatever the reason is. I'm not sure why it happened, but it was a wickedness that was in us. Well, what happened was somebody had to fight to get to be treated by the law equally. And what happens is now you don't have the freedom of association. You are not allowed to say, you know, I don't want to rent my apartment to you. You can't do that. It's against the law now. And now they're going to make it so you can't turn down a homosexual couple to rent your house. You won't be able to. You say, no, I don't believe in having my house as a place of fornication. And they'll say, whoa, is that right? And they'll sue you and you'll have to rent your house to them. Well, you don't have those freedoms because of the wickedness that was involved in our past. And the truth is, the focus on equality and on fairness is wrong. We ought to focus on other things. It's wrong. Well, I'm not going to go into that anymore. I've dealt with that enough. The side effect of the resistance or the reaction, shall we say, was not all that that was intended. Remember what I told you about side effects. Sometimes you fight for a certain thing and you wind up causing something else. You fight because your daughter can't get on the list for a lung transplant, and you fight and fight and fight and finally get your daughter a lung transplant because she was not old enough, but you finally get it and it rejects it, which was what's expected, and so you do it again and you fight and fight and get a second set of lungs for your lung transplant for your poor little daughter, and she survives and you got what you wanted. You saved your daughter's life and cost somebody else's daughter, two other people, their life. You didn't mean to do that, but that's what happens. And nobody is against the objective of saving your daughter. And I don't blame you at all for doing that, even if you knew that it was going to cost somebody else their lives. But you still have to realize that there are some side effects. Now, feminism has produced some side effects. It's caused some things. It has caused, folks, it has caused millions of people to die in abortion. This is feminism. You can lay it on to feminism. Women's rights. We want to be equal. And that might seem really good, but the side effects is not good. What it's caused as collateral damage is evil. And there are many others. But I'm going to deal with just this one other side effect that has come about, and that is the disenfranchisement of men from their God-given and DNA-inspired distinction. And that has caused a problem. What we have now is a whole nation, and I'm including the people in this room, a nation of people confused about manliness and confused about manhood and what it means to be a man. In fact, some people actually born males, and they don't appreciate that at all. They actually wish they had been females. All right. I'm going to look at some biblical references to manliness. I don't have enough time to completely cover it, but I'm going to try to cover a little bit of it. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 4. We've read the one where David says to Solomon, show thyself a man. And the objection is, but that's not talking about in comparison to women. It's talking about in comparison to boyhood children. I want you to notice that this is not the only place that that same type of thing is said. I think I said 1 Samuel chapter 4. Let's get some perspective here of what it means to be manly. I'm having the hardest time turning my pages. All right. Chapter 4, look at verse 9. It says, be strong. This is the Philistines saying it. Be strong and quit yourselves like men, O ye Philistines, that ye be not servants unto the Hebrews, as they have been to you. Quit yourselves like men and fight. All right. Quit yourselves like men and fight. First of all, be men in your fighting. Be men in your attitude right now in this battle. They thought they were going to lose this battle big time. The shout of God had come into the camp of the Israelites because they had brought in the Ark of the Covenant, and they heard that shout all the way into the camp of the Philistines, and the Philistines began to tremble and said, hey, we're in trouble now. Their mighty gods have come into their camp, and now we're in trouble. But then they had this attitude, well, it's die like men. It's stand up and fight like men. And what was the point? We don't want to be servants like they've been. We don't want that shame of being subservient and needy and dependent on them. So, do you see what it's talking about when it talks about manliness? It's talking about a sense of independence. A sense of self-reliance. A sense of control of your own destiny. That's the idea of manliness. Now, I know all women want the same thing. They would like that. But I'm telling you, this is the appropriate attitude for men. And they knew it, and it was something that they could honor. They could say, this is an appropriate attitude for men. And then at the same time, a little while later, it says, quit you like men and fight. Did you notice that men, to respect other men, have to see that they're willing to fight? Now, this is not just typical behavior of men that they're aggressive and wanting to get in a fight. It's an important aspect of manliness that you're willing to fight. You stand there, you know what they call it? They have all kinds of words for it. They say, he's got moxie. Why? Because this big old guy's threatening him, and he's just standing there saying, I'm minding my own business, bud. What are you going to do about it? You say, well, why is that so special? It's special. I'm telling you, it's special to men. And it's special as part of manliness. It's special because a man is willing to stand up and say, all right, I'll fight. I know I'm going to lose this fight, but I'm going to go down fighting. Yeah. Yeah. Amen. Now, I guess there are some women like that. But it seems a whole lot more appropriate in men. It's a sense of manliness. And these the Philistines understood. And the Israelites understood that too. So when Solomon is told by David, show yourself a man, he's not just saying, stop being immature, stop being a boy. He's saying, you're going to have to be a man among men. You're going to have to be the kind of a type of a leader that other people can look up to and say, that man is worthy of being followed. And that requires certain attitude in him. Now, I don't know if you realize it, but culture has produced this in our very way that we mature. Young men hit puberty and things happen to them that differentiates them from boyhood and femininity. The same thing. I don't know if you realize it, but you know, boys keep growing. A girl hits puberty and her actual physical frame stops growing. She levels off about at 15 years old. And, you know, the dates might be not exactly right, but somewhere around there, at the finish of puberty, her body stops growing. But not young men. Just try to feed them. Try to keep them. You realize that young men, because after they hit puberty, after they've passed up that time where they've changed certain things and their body has changed, they become adolescents, they become more mature in that sense, they start growing incredibly. They start needing a great amount of protein. Feed your boys, you people. Feed them. Feed them. Don't stunt their growth. Let them eat. They can eat 7,000 or 8,000 calories in one sitting. Buy a dozen Krispy Kreme donuts and watch them disappear. Man, they're just gone. But girls don't need that kind of protein. That's strange. But now let me say, what happens here is that the identification, the self-identification, and the self-esteem of young men comes from their shedding that tender aspect of boyhood and femininity, which are seen to them as the same. And this is in psychological studies. I've read it. I'm not going to quote it. I'm not going to do it. I might put it on my notes when you guys want to read them. You can look them up. But these are actual studies done. This creates in boys a self-esteem to become young men in shedding their appearance of femininity and boyhood or boyishness. Talk about the voice. The voice changes. First starts cracking and they get all, what's going on with my voice? And then all of a sudden you talk like Matthew, you know, I'm a real man, yeah. But girls don't go through that. Girls keep the same voice. Maybe there is some difference, but it's still a very feminine voice. That's what happens. And so there is a differentiating happening in adolescence for young men. Something happens to differentiate them from boyishness and femininity to becoming masculine. Now that's not manliness. Masculinity is not manliness. Manliness has to do with the character, not the outward appearance. But at the same time, you can see that in our culture, in all cultures, this happens to differentiate men from their immaturity and from femininity. And this is a very important component of young men's self-esteem. Maybe you think, you know, this stuff is not provable. You can't prove any of this stuff. And yeah, you might be right. Maybe I can't prove it. But I'm right, nonetheless. Many other things happen in that sense. I want you to understand that young men require this change in order to develop their sense of dignity as a man and their sense of approval as a man. And there becomes a greater expectation in certain areas for young men than there do of women. And this produces a cultural divide between men and women that is based in reality. This is based in reality. You can give in kindergarten, or for all your Christmases, you can give your boys unicorns, and you can give your girls fire truck engines and, you know, fire engines, and it's not going to change reality. It won't change who they are. And so feminism and this push for gender identity, you know, and transgender and homosexuality and all this stuff is not going to change real human nature. Real human nature has a definite component, and it's not just physical and cultural, it's also biblical. The Bible talks about men recognizing what they have to be because they are men and not because they're anything else. And what I'm trying to tell you is that requires a recognition on the part of our society that men deserve a certain type of respect, a distinguishing respect that they ought to get just because they're men. Not because they're special in some other way, just because they're men. The Bible makes it very clear. And men recognize that that's true. But when a culture such as ours has diminished that respect, that distinguishing respect of treating men like men, and men showing honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, showing honor to her as a woman, not because she's special, but because she's a woman. It's in the Bible. It's clear. It's produced by our DNA and by our culture. It is not something to be trampled on. It has a side effect of destroying our culture, which is what you're seeing on this imaginary culture in Hollywood. This imaginary world where people are very flexible and can be basically anything they want to be. All right, I'm going to read two more verses and finish out this morning. 2 Samuel chapter 10, verse 12. You'd be amazed how the Bible will define itself and make itself clear, even against your objections, if you have objections, if you would just allow it to speak. 2 Samuel chapter 10, verse 12. And one of the same place... That is not correct. I'm in 1 Samuel, no wonder. Sorry about that. 2 Samuel chapter 10 and verse 12. Be of good courage, and let us play the men for our people and for the cities of our God, and the Lord do that which seemeth Him good. All right, we're getting ready to go into a fight. What are we going to do? Well, let's play the men. Let's be men. As soldiers, we're going to have to take our role as men and do what's required of us. You get it, right? But what does that mean? Play the men. What does play the men mean? Well, the Bible's going to define it. 1 Chronicles chapter 19 and verse 13. Believe it or not, this is the same exact story. 1 Chronicles chapter 19 and verse 13. Be of good courage, and let us behave ourselves valiantly for our people and for the cities of our God, and let the Lord do that which is good in His sight. The Bible repeats the same thing twice. Once in 2 Samuel and once in 1 Chronicles. same thing, same occurrence, same statement. One time it says, let us play them in. The other time it says, let us behave ourselves valiantly. You get it? Men are expected to be valiant, courageous, to control their fears. I don't have time to keep on going on, but I'll just give you this little tidbit. All of the attributes of manliness have this one component in common, and that is control. Self-control, mastery over the elements or over your own fears or whatever, they all have that in common. So don't overlook this very important component. Mastery over your own fear. Be courageous. Be valiant. Play the man. Show yourself a man, Solomon. Be like a man ought to be. That's the idea of manliness. We'll go on from there next week.